I know that Scott suggested to some of you that a reasonable thing to try if you weren't sure what the heck was going on was to use cap bits to get the raw bits of the cape filling and print them. This won't work because there are at least two bugs in cap bits that, that Nate has just laboriously identified. They'll be fixed shortly. So if you tried that and the result was that your kernel asserted, that would have been a good outcome. Unfortunately, the bugs were such that the kernel might have gone south for the winter. It's amazing what happens if you don't examine the correct capability argument, and then having examined the wrong argument, then you then examine it the wrong way. Just stunning. Not needless to say, you know, the likelihood of getting the right answer under that chain of paths is not high. So we're going to reinstate something that was in the Eros code that's not in the Kaidos code. I was sort of reluctant to put it in because it's the kind of thing that you forget to take out and it cannot go into a production kernel. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to, the log has a printf option. In Eros, there was a variant of that that you could say, I want to printf this thing to the kernel log and I want to enter the kernel debugger. I do, immediately after the printf. And the reason to do that is while you're about to do a call, you think you know what's going on, but you know, it's the 5 billionth call into the kernel or into the system that's going south. You'd really like not to stop for all of the 4 billion and however many nines that would be prior to the call that's hurting you. So what you want is to issue a printf saying, I'm about to do the call that's hurting me, please stop, so you can poke around in the system state. So I will put that back in. This would all be much easier if we had a decent application level debugger, but we don't yet. Anybody want to volunteer? So that stuff will get, I hope, repaired. Nate also has a case where a reply appears to not be happening, and he's gonna. I'm gonna look at the code that is doing that and see what's going wrong. Okay. Open the floor for questions. Because you're all ready to hand this in, we can go home.
I want to implement which includes, right?
You want to implement a what interface?
I just want to implement the IO stream interface.
An existing interface?
Yes, right.
Okay.
In the text console file, there's an include in there that looks more like a Java import. What's the deal with that? And
okay.
Why? How do these
Okay. The pattern is that the pattern is not consistent. Okay, and there's actually a reason for that. Basically, the gist of it is that if as long as the INEL headers have been stuffed in the right directory, the current build system will just automatically generate the corresponding client-side headers, and it puts them into Kaidos user include IDL path. Where if your input IDL interface is kaidos.driver.textconsole, you'll end up with that header file in kaidos user include kaidos driver textconsole.h. At present, if you are the implementer of an interface, the assumption is, and this assumption is actually currently undergoing review, that you will emit local in your build tree for the service those header files that do the server side part of the protocol. And in that case, what happens is kaidos.driver.textconsole.idl will end up down in the text console tree. If you look in the build subdirectory, you'll see that there's a header file that is kaidos.driver.textconsole.server.h. The .server.h is at least half a clue. Now, as to why these don't agree on path conventions, this actually has to do with getting the dependency structures right in the makefile, and we're considering just saying, look, to hell with it, just generate the server-side header files into user include as well, because it doesn't really do any harm to put them there. They're more or less fixed content.
And now, where is the server.h?
Well, if you're building text console, you'll be down in the text console directory. The server.h will end up down in the build subdirectory. Okay. There's no reason that the server.h should be particularly private. And I think this was a judgment error on our part not to just publish it. The idea was to try to avoid cluttering the header file tree But once you call them .server or .h, I think it's fairly clear what's going on. Or at least it's clear that you're not looking at the right header if you were looking for the client header. So I think we will probably revise the thing and just publish them. Does that answer your... Okay, so that's the header that describes the IDL interface. And if you're on the server side, that's the header you need to implement the IDL. So the general pattern in Capital is there are some arguments that specify search paths and output directories. But the general pattern is it's one of dash C, dash S, or dash T. Exactly one of these. They're mutually exclusive. And I'm ignoring the path manipulation options. Follow by a sequence of IDL files. And what you will get out if you say dash C is in the target directory that you specified, and somewhere, actually, the target directory in that case is the top of a directory tree, you will get a .h file, the client side .h file, if you said dash C, corresponds to each of the specified input IDL files. If you said dash S, you will get a server side header file corresponding to each of the specified IDL files. Now, the difference that in the client case, you're going to get a subtree. In the server case, you're going to get this flattened namespace. I think that's a bug, and I think we should just change. If you say dash T, you get a template file emitted. It's a good start on the beginnings of the server dispatch processing for this list of interfaces that you provide. Not complete, there's stuff you've got to add to it, but it's most of the hard work. So the metal thing is dash C for client, dash S for service, dash T for template. The idea is you'll get a template.c file. You probably want to rename that. And then you'll edit it to start building whatever your service is. Obviously, the template will not include the actual implementation of your service. The do what I mean instruction was not available when we implemented Capital. So, file a bug on that. I answered the question about IDL-related header files.
Yeah.
The search paths, right? You need to make sure that you have the client headers in your search path because the server headers refer to them. Actually, most of the structures the server needs are already emitted in the client code. Client header. The server-side header reuses them in fetch and demarshalling procedures.
Yes.
You had a question over there, right?
I think it was answered. It was just
import.
Yeah.
Import in
Cap
IDL or in make image? Okay, because as far as I know, I didn't say anything about import.
You're on when you were talking about.
Again, if you have an NKI file that's using image.loadSmall, it's a mistake. At least you end up in this swamp. Let me explain to you what's going on. In general, the assumption is that a process has a fault handler sitting behind its address space that is prepared to grow its address space. For example, this thing will get you more stack pages when you need them. Grow your heap when you need to. It knows how to map portions of your binary file when you need it. There's a bit of a reductio problem, right? At some point in the system, there have to be some processes that don't get any help, because otherwise, how would we implement the processes that help? And then also, there are some processes that need to be able to do what might be described as unclean manipulations of their own address spaces. In particular, the address space fault handler is something that you would like to implement without having it, in turn, need an address space fault handler. Right? It doesn't get to be turtles all the way down. And for a change, I will not tell it again. If you say load small, you're saying, I want a process that will fit in this very peculiar address space model we have. It's a very weird special case that this process will actually run parasitically in the address space of other processes. Using segmentation to do that, we're using it mainly to speed context switching. This is one of these misfeatures that may now no longer be motivated. The other thing about it is it runs using the small model runtime, and the small model runtime does not include an address space fault handler. It also runs with exactly one, count them one, stack page. And there are client-side stubs that will not operate with only one stack page. Fortunately, they include kprintf. I think we had a fix. And there are a bunch of things in Capital that ought to work better.
That's the issue.
We were reluctant to rely on Alloc A because A is still not robustly implemented. Anyway, if you use load elf, what you will get is a space derived from an elf binary backed by a fault handler that knows how to deal with elf binaries. Well, also, not only a load elf, but then in the link line, not say dash L small. It advises the linker that you wanted the small runtime. These things sort of have to go together. Yeah?
It's also
thank you. Dash small space. Dash large dash space is the default. If you're copying the text console make file and NKI, make sure you get rid of the dash small dash space, and then in the MKI, make sure you use load L. If you make those two changes, it should all just work. Next question. We're puzzled about driver. Oh, somebody asked, why is this a driver? Why does this belong in the driver tree? The answer is, it doesn't. If I thought about it in advance, I would have created a stream subtree. But for the moment, it actually really doesn't matter very much where you put it. Scott tells me that some of you are puzzled about the role of constructors in this whole mess. In particular, you know, the test process, right, is getting created in some sense as a self-standing primordial process. But the null streaming process is getting fabricated out of a constructor. What's going on with that? Some people will probably know. The job of the constructor is to instantiate copies of things. So essentially, a constructor is a large body of code that implements spawn, or if you prefer, a forking set. If you're accustomed to the Unix way of doing things, and you wanted to open a null stream, which in Unix wouldn't be called a stream, you'd go and run the open system call on dev null. And you get back a file descriptor, and then above that, the standard I.O. library would do something approximating an infinite amount of work for no purpose. If you open dev null and I open dev null, there's no worrying about data going back and forth between us. Why not? Is it that something I write to dev null can't get to your process? Take a risk. First I'm going to do is make fun of me. Well, in the same boat here. I make fun of me too.
The bits are just discarded.
The bits are discarded. Why do you know that? The contract on the interface. No. Contract on the interface is that you will write a certain number of bits. The behavior of the interface is not part of the interface contract. Behavior contract and interface contract, and they're different. And I'm picking on it because that's actually a key issue here. You're right that you're relying on a part of the behavior contract. What's the part of the behavior contract you're relying on? The bits will be thrown away. So why do you believe that happens? Trust your kernel, or fool you. I don't know where that kernel's been. Okay. Or perhaps worse, you do if you're running Linux. Okay. Now, why? So look, kernel is not something you trust because you want to. It's something you trust because you don't have a choice. And you know, anything with 250,000 lines of code can't go right. So indeed, you trust it because the implementation of that object is provided by the primordial trusted computing base in Linux. The computing base node is an advertising assertion. It has nothing to do with facts. Suppose you and I hold a capability to the same implementation of a Kyoto's null stream. I do a write system call or write invocation on the null stream. It happens. You know what happens? Kyoto gets discarded. How do you know that? How do you know it's null stream? You certainly know that you hold a capability. You know what it points to. With who? I'm doing this just to be a jerk. There's actually a point that I'm trying to get at. What you're, I think, groping after is you're suddenly realizing you don't know. The answer is you don't know. No. Why do you know that that opens the kernel null device? This is a name. It's a string. There's some association between this string and a piece of code. Why do you know that association is there? Well, a major and minor number is just a fancy way of encoding a string. Why not? It wouldn't actually be backed by code. Why? I mean, so you say I can't make up a major and minor number because it wouldn't be backed by code. Why not? God didn't wake up this morning and say, you know, these major and minor numbers, they're backed by that code over there, right? God doesn't do kernels. Sorry.
Well, he did one.
He did one? Okay, just, okay, I, you know, I gotta go for this. Which kernel was that? I'm kind of curious.
We just don't have code to it.
Oh, it's right. God did one kernel and is proprietary. That explains a lot of what's going on in Redmond when you think about it. Oh, wait, it's Larry Ellison, I think. thinks he's God. Certainly God doesn't think he's Larry Ellison. Okay. How do you know? Trust your kernel. We've been there. Well, yes and no, right? I mean, first, it turns out device numbers, device number for dev null, I think, is still stable. In modern kernels, device numbers are often dynamically assigned, so it's actually not about the device number. There is a binding from this directory entry to some major-minor pair. There is, in turn, a binding from that major-minor pair to some device entry. You don't know who implements it. There's nothing to stop you from implementing a loadable kernel module that takes over the dev null endpoint. So I should make this a homework exercise so that you'll really get that. You expect to get the null device because you'll rely on the good faith of, you know, Linus and 250,000 of his nearest and dearest friends. Okay? And the only thing working in your favor is that's a smaller number than Bill relies on. By several zeros. Well, that's a little unfair. I mean, you also know that there's some inspection process going on against the Linux kernel and also against the Windows kernel. There are, in fact, many eyeballs trained on the Linux kernel. The bad news is most of them are shut. What you want is well-trained eyeballs. I didn't say blind. I said shut, okay? Well, you shouldn't believe it. In the dev null case, the answer is you believe it because it's part of the behavior contract of the TCB. And if you don't trust the TCB, you shouldn't be running your code there. We will dodge the bullet of how you know your TCB is actually running, being simulated. The thing about software is you can simulate anything.
Really paranoid.
I hope so. Let's turn the question around, right? If you're insufficiently paranoid, can you get anything? Go for the best, right?
Right, go for the best.
Hey, it works for Windows users all over the world, right? Okay. I don't want to go on an airplane built that way. And it's also not, I mean, look, you may at the end say, I'm relying on a chain of trust that isn't actually there, and I now understand that it's not actually there, but I have to go back and get my work done, so I'm going to blissfully return to my willfully ignorant state and assert that it was there and not worry about it. That's not an unreasonable thing to do at the end of the day. Right? I'm not saying don't run around naked. I'm saying don't run around naked without knowing you're running around naked. Hey, it's fun.
It's fun.
We're not going to make that an in-class exercise, just for the record. See, I heard a big sigh of relief from somebody. There is such a thing as being too paranoid. You want to know when you're standing at risk. You want to know where the risk is coming from. So in this case, what do you know? Right? In the null stream Kyoto's case, what do you know? I mean, what you might argue, I had a binding in a namespace somewhere to dev null. I had a contract with the system administrator that the primordial system image, this thing was actually bound to a null stream. And the reason I trust the null stream is it's part of the primordial system image and it's part of the TCB. And that's essentially the story that you have with Linux. There's a process plus a kernel involved, right? But we're already in the mold in Kyoto's where parts of the TCB can be implemented by non-supervisor mode code. That's not a fundamental alteration in the story. But let's assume for a minute that we didn't know that. You're handed a capability. Do you even know that it implements the null stream? Why not? You even know that it implements the IOStream protocol. I don't even know that it's valid. Well, you know that if you invoke it, something will happen, because you know it's a well-formed capability. You know that it's well-formed. But you don't know to what object. You know it's well-formed because you know it exists. It's well-formed in the same sense that there's always a value in that integer, even if you don't know what it is. Well, suppose you issue the get type operation, and it comes back and says, my type is IOStream. How do you know that it implements an IOStream? There's a reason that that operation is called get alleged type. How do you know that it alleges to implement IOStream? It might, in fact, be a front-end object. Passes your message through to something that's really an IOStream. Maybe something that, you know, send data off to Mars. The Martians are eagerly reading everything you have to say. Better than me. Okay. Look, the only way you ever know anything about the behavior of an object is by virtue of a trust relationship ultimately with the implementer. That may be transitive through a supply chain, right? But you have a chain of people who've check that something is true, and you're trusting that chain of people to execute their job. That's why you think dev null opens the null device in Linux. Or, because you were standing in a position to make sure that the thing that you cared about was enforced. So the constructor, which is the point of the story, actually has two functions. One is, it implements the common process startup logic, and it's really convenient to only do that in one place, even if you don't need any of its other properties. It's really helpful not to have to write your own runtime from scratch. All the libraries are going to rely on you playing ball with the normal runtime. Normal runtime is regrettably complicated enough that you probably would prefer not to do it for yourself. There's another contracting constructor. It guarantees that whatever it builds, and whatever code that thing runs, if you send it a message, that message can't go to anybody else other than you through an overt channel. Overt channel checking is beyond the scope of what anybody knows how to do. There are cases where what you want to know, there are two separate levels. One is the privacy of my data respected? Second is my data handled correctly? Two separate questions. The first one is something we actually know how to answer, or at least know how to enforce, generically. It's not a guarantee that the program will not attempt to leak your data. It's a guarantee that structurally the program is fabricated in an environment in which it cannot leak your data. Also, incidentally, an environment where if the program goes awry, you can pull the ripcord and destroy it. Because the constructor is guaranteed that all of its storage came from a source of storage that you provided. You can destroy that source of storage and therefore anything that got allocated from it. So, suppose you had a music decoder. Imagine why you would want one of those, but some people do. And you want to be able to play a protected MP3 file, and you don't want those helpful people of the Recording Industry Association to know that you played this protected MP3 file. It's possible to guarantee that the RIAA MP3 decoder cannot communicate with the RIAA. The constructor contract. RIAA decoder, for its part, may say, but if I can't, I won't play music. The other half of, four or five halves of the constructor contract is that the party implementing the process knows that you can't inspect the process state unless the process agrees to go public. Because you never had access to the binary. That was held by the constructor. Now, why do you trust the constructor? It's part of the trusted computing base. If I want to implement proprietary code, there's a problem in transmitting the code to you to get it put on your system without you reading it. But if I get past that problem, and there are a couple of ways to do that, and I can get it embodied in a constructor, that process can hold secrets from you on your machine. You can destroy it. You can elect not to run it. Elect to run it and stop it. You can determine whether or not that process has channels to the outside world. But that process can hold proprietary data or secrets, keys, things like that, that short of disk forensics, you can't get. And in the presence of a trusted platform module, you can't get them even in the presence of disk forensics. In the presence of a trusted platform module, you can't even get them off the disk or patching the kernel. Indeed, you can patch the kernel to change the kernel. So when I say short of disk forensics, what I'm really saying is short of a certain level of really difficult obscurity. I want to get hard security out of that. I've got to go to cryptography, and I need the TPM to do so. That's what the constructor's role is. And in this case, I don't actually know, when I open the null stream object, what protocol it implements. But I do know, by virtue of the fact that it came from a constructor, that whatever data I send it isn't going anywhere else. What, though, is if I send it data, will it reply? I'm not saying there's no implementation contract. There needs to be a behavior contract in real systems. The reason you want constraints on information flow is partly security, because the viruses are not out to help you, but also partly failure management. If a subsystem fails, you want to know what the possible scope of impact of the failure is. And the possible scope of impact is encapsulated by the limits on the process's communication. So you'd really like to know what those are. And you'd really like to get subsystems that are isolated from each other so that you can test them in isolation and figure out who went wrong in a fine-grained way.
The constructors are implemented in the MKI files, or just processed.
Yeah, okay, good. So there are one of the things that I said about the MKI files when I was introducing them is that they're very peculiar, right? They're creating a system image containing processes that are going to be running at time t0. So the job of makeImage is to hand fabricate those objects. So in the case of Text Console, in the very first version of Text Console, we formulated that as a boot process, one that was just initially running at the start of the world, and nobody talked to it. In the new logic, the Text Console state is installed in a constructor using the makeImage toolset. It is the constructor itself that is the boot process. And so when the system comes up, the constructor is running. The test case has a capability to the constructor which it uses to instantiate the Text Console. And having instantiated the Text Console, it then goes and makes calls to the Text Console. It's the constructor that's the primordial process there. I'm going to follow up on that because I want to make sure I got the rest of this question. No, the Text Console is actually a great example of something where you really only want one of them. And the reason you're going to use the constructor for this is mostly so that you don't have to redo all of the primordial runtime setup that would normally go with that. In particular, the fact that it's in a constructor has a side effect in the makeImage, but it's all under the same bank. So one of the reasons we do this is later, right, we're going to have a piece of code that goes around, probes your hardware, and instantiates the drivers you presently need. We would then like to release the memory for the drivers you do not need. The most straightforward way to do that is to shoot their space banks. In order to do that, we need to get them under unique space banks. That's actually the real reason we're paying the constructors for that case. Is there one of your questions?
Just how do I, a new process, if you said that the constructor...
At runtime or at makeImage?
At runtime.
Okay. So the general answer is, if I'm a developer, right, I'm going to run a compiler, I'm going to get out a file, and I'm going to have a utility program. The utility program is going to go to the meta constructor, and it's going to instantiate a constructor. It's going to get a builder's capability to that constructor, which is something you don't see in the makeImage mechanism, because makeImage is doing it by sleazery, okay? And the protocol is you basically take this builder's capability and say, here's the address space, right? Here's the first tool, here's the second tool, okay? Good. I'm done putting capabilities into the constructor. Let me seal that constructor. Now I get a requester's capability. That's the client version. That's the one that in makeImage you're using to request instantiation. Could you do it another way? Yeah, if you wanted to implement a POSIX emulator on top of the system, you could do all the glory of fork and exec if you were somewhat of it. Elf space is doing a good chunk of that, right? Because it has to know all of the logic about, and Elf is not just a file format, it's a set of assumptions about the runtime environment and the address space that Elf space knows. No questions. By the way, nobody has to stay past 5 o'clock or indeed past 10 to 5, but I'm perfectly willing to stay a little later because I know people have been struggling. If you do not feel like you can go out and deal with the MKI files, this is a really good time to ask questions. So. Okay, so the question is, if a new process is fabricated, it has an endpoint for incoming messages, where did that endpoint get built? And the answer is, so the problem is if you do not have an incoming endpoint, you're not going to get any messages at all. So we chose to fabricate the initial incoming endpoint, usually in the constructor, or if you did a boot process, it got fabricated down there. So what you hold at your T0, if you're a process, build an endpoint capability to your incoming endpoint. The reason you have to fabricate your own entry capability to pass back is only you can decide what protected payload you want to put in that entry capability, and also only you can decide what endpoint ID should live in that endpoint, and you need a chance to set those things before I start calling you. Did I answer that question? Similarly, at time T0, you have been passed an entry capability. The guy who built you said, here's where I want my reply. You may notice that at the bottom of the initialize routine, there's a funny looking call that says reply to constructor or something like that, reply from constructor. That's actually implementing the reply phase of the constructor create call. Very weird case. Normally the guy who replies is the guy who got the request. In this case, it's not. Have people figured out how to put directories in the tree? Get them built, get them visited? What else came up that you have run into that people seem to be a little puzzled about? How many people have a working null stream at this point? That's sort of what I thought. How many people really want to be asking questions concerning why they might not have a working null stream?
Where's my response going?
We'll work on it. Obviously, the null stream's working.
Claims to be.
and reply.
It's kind of hard to test.
Does anyone have a
Ubuntu? Yeah.
Pretty kind enough to see. I think I'm doing it right, but aliens.
If you were running on Ubuntu, and you send me a question of the form, why didn't this curious part of my compiler? My answer is going to be because you're running on Ubuntu.
Right.
And it's not that I want to be obnoxious, it's that there's only so many systems I can support.
And that's what I was going to ask. Was this point, do you think it's worth going through all the trouble?
I can tell you we have a number of people in the community who are running on Ubuntu apparently successfully. The problem is that when they report something weird going on, it's very hard to reproduce. What may be going on. I've actually been toying with bringing up an Ubuntu environment just because we have enough people, but I kind of don't want to leave them dangling. It is not realistic to think that I'm going to get that done helpfully in time to help this assignment or even this semester or otherwise, but it's not. So that's a good point. And if you run a Fedora installation off the pen drive, you can mount your local FS. Or bootable CD for that.
Mixed results on bootable CDs.
What I've seen is that the F7 respins are much better than the original F7 release. On the other hand, wait a week and you can run F8 and really be perhaps the hemorrhaging edge. Okay.
We have one of
the public. When the mirror is up to date, we seem to run out of problems, but we're working on it.
Uh-oh.
The problem is that F8 is going to mirrors now, so
it's going to be easy.
Okay.
I've also gotten generic Solaris packages.
Solaris packages? You're a brave soul. Okay. Who feels at this point that they sort of have a handle on MKI files? But when I actually put out a hard due date for this, who feels that they're going to be completely lost? So, are you able to articulate a question that might help you get past this? I'll give you a tip. Unfortunately, I don't, well, actually, unfortunately, I do work a lot of weekends, but that's because I have to, and I try to keep that to a minimum. So the questions that come to me on a Saturday or a Sunday are unlikely to get answered quickly. That's just how it is. I apologize for it, but that's part of what happened here. You can articulate a question that might help get you unstuck, or even to the point where you don't even know the question. You can sort of run out of questions. How many people want to take a risk and ask a question? Yeah. Does that make sense of where you're stuck? Last three.
Go by these.
So you know some, there's a wonderful piece of sign language. This is a book. the assignment. Okay, so fair enough. The assignment only got out by email on Friday, but there's been enough warnings coming over the last few weeks that it's time to actually roll over and look. So I would suggest it's time to roll over and look. Okay, I've done picking on these. Anybody else sort of at the point where we are able to articulate something they might be stuck on? Okay. IF_IDL is interface IDL. It's not a conditional. And IFMKI, IF probably makes no sense there. What happened was I added a variable for the interface IDLs and then needed a variable for the MKIs. There will be a hard deadline coming for me. Last time, if anybody wants to leave, he's welcome to go. I'm trying to help.
Our deadline is due this week?
It was due today. And I agreed that, I had said I wasn't going to be aggressive about that because I knew the assignment was going to be, and it wasn't reasonable, but people certainly should have been looking at it, and this is not a hard enough assignment that I'm not going to actually say Thursday, I'm probably going to say Friday, but in principle, this is not a hard enough assignment that it would be reasonable. The actual novel code involved is measured mostly about sorting through how to get something built. Now, there have been some kernel bugs emerging, and that's nobody's fault. I'm not going to hold that against anybody. But this is the first step for a longer path. We need to get first. The deadline for this was this Tuesday. Next Tuesday was intended to be for the implementation of a pipe object. I said it would be coming. I actually said, yeah, so you're right. What I had said in the email was that I was going to be next Tuesday be the deadline for the pipe object and for these as well. But the reasoning was that would give people a week to look at these, get stuck, realize that this actually required their attention. That only worked for some people. So, very well, people frown on changing deadlines, but I'll tell you, if I don't make the deadline for this Thursday, I promise you won't get the pipe object done by Tuesday. So, I'll figure out what I'm going to do with this tonight. I don't have to change the deadline. It's really ought to be doable by tonight. Having said that, I also should say, I haven't implemented one either, because I've been traveling, and so one of the things that I need to do tomorrow is to implement one myself and make sure there's hidden bugs that are going to happen. The other side of that is, by tomorrow noon, there will not no longer be any between the bugs that would get in anybody's way. This can mostly be done by cut and paste, small edits. Not that bad. The part that's going to be the struggle is getting the right incantations to capital, to get a template built, to get the make files built, to get your directories created. Are there bugs in 6.6 that impact the small set of scripts we actually already built?
Not if you want to do F commands on by command.
Yes, that's one of those misfeatures.
That's fixed in 6 and defined.
When we set up our scripts, I wanted to do that. Ran into this bug, and I'm sitting there thinking, you know, I built the debugger in 1986 that got this right. And it wasn't the first one! I suspect that GDB scripting may be passed by. I'm not going to do it tonight because Tuesday night is babysitter night. But I will, at some point between now and tomorrow, get a null stream of my own built and going. A test case for it. Scott, yes.
This team during office made an appointment.
What are your office?
Okay, from 2 to 4.
Yes, that would be a good reason not to make the meeting. It's not that I object to being obnoxious. It's just that I don't want to be obnoxious unintentionally. Okay. All right. Thank you all.